Chapter 13. It would put all thought of a tender wish on his part out of Sue's mind, and make her intercourse with him free and fearless. It was with some heartache that he saw how little he cared for the freedom and fearlessness that would result in her from such knowledge. Some little time before the date of this service in the cathedral, the pretty, liquid-eyed, light-footed young woman Sue Brighthead had an afternoon's holiday, and leaving the ecclesiastical establishment in which she, not only assisted but lodged, took a walk into the country with a book in her hand. It was one of those cloudless days which sometimes occur in Wessex and elsewhere between days of cold and wet, as if intercalated by caprice of the weather god. She went along for a mile or two until she came to much higher ground than that of the city as he had left behind her. The road passed between green fields, and coming to a stile, Sue paused there to finish the page she was reading, and then looked back at the towers and domes and pinnacles new and old. On the other side of the stile, in the footpath, she beheld a foreigner with black hair and a sallow face, sitting on the grass beside a large square board whereon were fixed, as closely as they could stand, a number of plaster statuettes, some of them bronzed, which he was rearranging before proceeding with them on his way. They were in the main reduced copies of ancient marbles, and comprised divinities of a very different character from those the girl was accustomed to see portrayed, among them being a Venus of standard pattern, a Diana, and, of the other sex, Apollo, Bacchus, and Mars. Though the figures were many yards away from her, the southwest sun brought them out so brilliantly against the green herbage that she could discern their contours with luminous distinctness, and being almost in a line between herself and the church towers of the city, they awoke in her an oddly foreign and contrasting set of ideas by comparison. The man rose, and, seeing her, politely took off his cap, and cried, "Aye, mages," in an accent that agreed with his appearance. In a moment he dexterously lifted upon his knee the great board with its assembled notabilities divine and human, and raised it to the top of his head, bringing them unto her, and resting the board on the stile. First he offered her his smaller wares, the busts of kings and queens, then a minstrel, then a winged cupid. She shook her head. "How much are these two?" she said, touching with her finger the Venus, and the Apollo, the largest figures on the tray. He said she should have them for 10 shillings. "I cannot afford that," said Sue. She offered considerably less, and to her surprise the image man drew them from their wire stay, and handed them over the stile. She clasped them as treasures. When they were paid for, and the man had gone, she began to be concerned as to what she should do with them. They seemed so very large now that they were in her possession, and so very naked. Being of a nervous temperament, she trembled at her enterprise. When she handled them, the white pipiclay came off on her gloves and jacket. After carrying them along a little way openly, an idea came to her, and, pulling some huge burdock leaves, parsley, and other rank growths from the hedge, she wrapped up her burden as well as she could in these, so that what she carried appeared to be an enormous armful of green stuff gathered by a zealous lover of nature. "Well, anything is better than those everlasting church fowls," she said. But she was still in a trembling state, and seemed almost to wish as he had not bought the figures. Occasionally peeping inside the leaves, to see that Venus's arm was not broken, she entered with her heathen load into the most Christian city in the country by an obscure street running parallel to the main one, and round a corner to the side door of the establishment to which she was attached. Her purchases were taken straight up to her own chamber, and she at once attempted to lock them in a box that was her very own property. But finding them too cumbersome, she wrapped them in large sheets of brown paper, and stood them on the floor in a corner. The mistress of the house, Miss Fontover, was an elderly lady in spectacles, dressed almost like an abbess, a dab at ritual, as become one of her business, and a worshipper at the ceremonial church of St. Silas, in the suburb of Beersheba before mentioned, which Jude also had begun to attend. She was the daughter of a clergyman in reduced circumstances, and at his death, which had occurred several years before this date, she boldly avoided penury by taking over a little shop of church requisites and developing it to its present creditable proportions. She wore a cross and beads round her neck as her only ornament, and knew the Christian ear by heart. She now came to call Sue to tea, and, finding that the girl did not respond for a moment, entered the room just as the other was hastily putting a string round each parcel. "Something you have been buying, Miss Brighthead?" she asked, regarding the enwrapped objects. "Yes, just something to ornament my room," said Sue. "Well, I should have thought I had put enough here already," said Miss Fontover, looking round at the Gothic framed prints of saints, the church text scrolls, and other articles which, having become too stale to sell, had been used to furnish this obscure chamber. "Had it? How bulky!" She tore a little hole, about as big as a wafer, in the brown paper, and tried to peep in. "Hi, statuary? Two figures? Where did you get them?" "Oh, I bought them of a traveling man who sells casts to saints."
"Yes.
What ones?" "Saint Peter and Saint Mary Magdalene." "Well, now come down to tea, and go and finish that organ text, if there's light enough afterwards." These little obstacles to the indulgence of what had been the merest passing fancy created in Sue a great zest for unpacking her objects and looking at them. And at bedtime, when she was sure of being undisturbed, she unrobed the divinities in comfort. Placing the pair of figures on the chest of drawers, a candle on each side of them, she withdrew to the bed, flung herself down thereon, and began reading a book she had taken from her box, which Miss Fontover knew nothing of. It was a volume of Gibbon, and she read the chapter dealing with the reign of Julian the Apostate. Occasionally she looked up at the statuettes, which appeared strange and out of place, there happening to be a Calvary print hanging between them, and, as if the scene suggested the action, she at length jumped up and withdrew another book from her box, a volume of verse, and turned to the familiar poem, "Thou Hast Conquered, O Pale Galilean. The world has grown gray from thy breath," which she read to the end. Presently she put out the candles, undressed, and finally extinguished her own light. She was of an age which usually sleeps soundly, yet tonight she kept waking up, and every time she opened her eyes there was enough diffused light from the street to show her the white plaster figures, standing on the chest of drawers in odd contrast to their environment of text and martyr, and the Gothic framed crucifix picture that was only discernible now as a Latin cross, the figure thereon being obscured by the shades. On one of these occasions the church clocks struck some small hour. It fell upon the ears of another person who sat bending over his books at a not very distant spot in the same city. Being Saturday night, the morrow was one on which Jude had not set his alarm clock to call him at his usually early time, and hence he had stayed up, as was his custom, 2 or 3 hours later than he could afford to do on any other day of the week. Just then he was earnestly reading from his prize box text. At the very time that Sue was tossing and staring at her figures, the policemen and belated citizens passing along under his window might have heard, if they had stood still, strange syllables mumbled with fervor within words that had for Jude an indescribable enchantment. Inexplicable sounds something like these: "All hemen ice theos ho pater, ex hu ta panta, chi hem ice ice autan," till the sounds rolled with reverent loudness, as a book was heard too close. "Chi eis curios iesus Christos, di hu ta panta chi hem eis di autu." IV, he was a handy man at his trade, an all-round man, as artisans in country towns are apt to be. In London the man who carves the boss, or knob of leafage declines to cut the fragment of molding which merges in that leafage, as if it were a degradation, to do the second half of one whole. When there was not much Gothic molding for Jude to run, or much window tracery on the bankers, he would go out lettering monuments or tombstones, and take a pleasure in the change of handiwork. The next time that he saw her was when he was on a ladder executing a job of this sort inside one of the churches. There was a short morning service, and when the parson entered, Jude came down from his ladder and sat with the half dozen people forming the congregation till the prayer should be ended and he could resume his tapping. He did not observe till the service was half over that one of the women was Sue, who had perforce accompanied the elderly Miss Fontover thither. Jude sat watching her pretty shoulders, her easy, curiously nonchalant risings and sittings, and her perfunctory genuflections, and thought what a help such an Anglican would have been to him in happier circumstances. It was not so much his anxiety to get on with his work that made him go up to it immediately the worshippers began to take their leave. It was that he dared not, in this holy spot, confront the woman who was beginning to influence him in such an indescribable manner. Those three enormous reasons why he must not attempt intimate acquaintance with Sue Brighthead, now that his interest in her had shown itself to be unmistakably of a sexual kind, loomed as stubbornly as ever. But it was also obvious that man could not live by work alone, that the particular man Jude, at any rate, wanted something to love. Some men would have rushed incontinently to her, snatched the pleasure of easy friendship which he could hardly refuse, and have left the rest to chance. Not so Jude at first. But as the days, and still more particularly the lonely evenings, dragged along, he found himself, to his moral consternation, to be thinking more of her instead of thinking less of her, and experiencing a fearful bliss in doing what was erratic, informal, and unexpected. Surrounded by her influence all day, walking past the spots she frequented, he was always thinking of her, and was obliged to own to himself that his conscience was likely to be the loser in this battle. To be sure, she was almost an ideality to him still. Perhaps to know her would be to cure himself of this unexpected and unauthorized passion. A voice whispered that, though he desired to know her, he did not desire to be cured. There was not the least doubt that from his own orthodox point of view the situation was growing immoral. For Sue to be the loved one of a man who was licensed by the laws of his country to love Arabella, and none other unto his life's end, was a pretty bad second beginning, when the man was bent on such a course as Jude purposed. This conviction was so real with him that one day when, as was frequent, he was at work in a neighboring village church alone, he felt it to be his duty to pray against his weakness. But much as he wished to be an exemplar in these things, he could not get on. It was quite impossible, he found, to ask to be delivered from temptation when your heart's desire was to be tempted unto 70 times 7. So he excused himself. After all, he said, it is not altogether an erotolepsy that is the matter with me, as at that first time. I can see that she is exceptionally bright, and it is partly a wish for intellectual sympathy, and a craving for loving kindness in my solitude. Thus he went on adoring her, fearing to realize that it was human perversity. For whatever Sue's virtues, talents, or ecclesiastical saturation, it was certain that those items were not at all the cause of his affection for her. On an afternoon at this time, a young girl entered the stonemason's yard with some hesitation, and, lifting her skirts to avoid draggling them in the white dust, crossed towards the office. "That's a nice girl," said one of the men known as Uncle Joe. "Who is she?" asked another. "I don't know, I've seen her about here and there." "Why, yes, she's the daughter of that clever chap Brighthead who did all the wrought iron work at St. Silas's 10 years ago, and went away to London afterwards. I don't know what he's doing now, not much I fancy, as she's come back here." Meanwhile, the young woman had knocked at the office door and asked if Mr. Jude Foley was at work in the yard. It so happened that Jude had gone out somewhere or other that afternoon, which information she received with a look of disappointment, and went away immediately. When Jude returned, they told him and described her, whereupon he exclaimed, "Why, that's my cousin Sue." He looked along the street after her, but she was out of sight. He had no longer any thought of a conscientious avoidance of her, and resolved to call upon her that very evening. And when he reached his lodging, he found a note from her, a first note, one of those documents which, simple and commonplace in themselves, are seen retrospectively to have been pregnant with impassioned consequences. The very unconsciousness of a looming drama which is shown in such innocent first epistles from women to men, or vice versa, makes them, when such a drama follows, and they are read over by the purple, or lurid light of it, all the more impressive, solemn, and in cases, terrible. Sue's was of the most artless and natural kind. She addressed him as her dear cousin Jude. Said as he had only just learned by the merest accident that he was living in Christminster, and reproached him with not letting her know. They might have had such nice times together, she said, for she was thrown much upon herself, and had hardly any congenial friend. But now there was every probability of her soon going away, so that the chance of companionship would be lost perhaps forever. A cold sweat overspread Jude at the news that she was going away. That was a contingency he had never thought of, and it spurred him to write all the more quickly to her. He would meet her that very evening, he said, 1 hour from the time of writing, at the cross in the pavement which marked the spot of the martyrdoms. When he had dispatched the note by a boy, he regretted that in his Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.